but she had her mother's full mouth and elegant nose. Maggie, my daughter. My heart all but stopped beating, and then it lurched into high gear in pure terror. What should I do? What should I say? I mean, I had known I was a father and whatnot, but now she was looking at me, and she was a person. She regarded me soberly from the top of the stairs for several long seconds before she said,
"Are you Harry Dresden?"
She was missing a tooth from up front and off to one side. It was kind of adorable. I said, "Yeah, that's me."
"You're really big," she said.
"You think so?" She nodded seriously.
"Bigger than Mr. Carpenter."
I said, "How did you know it was me?"
"Because Molly showed me your picture,"
Maggie said. She moved her shoulders as though attempting to hold Mouse up the way she might a favorite doll.
"This is my dog, Mouse."
Mouse wagged his tail furiously and managed not to knock Maggie down while he did it. "I know," I said. "I'm the one who gave him to you." Maggie nodded.
"That's what Molly said. She said you gave him to me 'cause you loved me."
"Yes," I said, recognizing the truth as I spoke it. "That's true." She wrinkled up her nose as if she smelled something unpleasant.
"Are you mad at me?"
I blinked several times. "What? No, no, of course not. Why would I be mad at you?" She shrugged and looked down at Mouse's mane.
"Because you aren't ever here? Never ever."
"Ow. The winter mantle is pretty amazing, but there are some kinds of pain it can't do jack about." "Well," I said after a moment, "I have a very tough job. Do you know what I do?"
"You fight monsters," Maggie said. "Molly told me so, like Dracula's and stuff."
Had Molly been filling in for me a little while I was away? That sounded a lot like the kind of thing Mab had done or ordered done when I was unavailable, taking up some of the duties of her vassal in his stead. Maybe Molly was following in the same footsteps, or maybe she was just being Molly and being as kind as she could to the child. Or maybe it wasn't as simple as either or. "Yeah," I said, "like Dracula's and stuff. It's very dangerous, and I do it a lot."
"Mr. Carpenter works harder than two men. That's what Mrs. Carpenter says."
"That's probably true," I said.
"But he comes home every night, and you haven't ever..."
A thought seemed to strike her, and she pressed a little closer to Mouse.
"Are you going to take me away?"
I said, blinking. This was proceeding really quickly. Would you like that?" She shrugged, almost hiding her eyes in Mouse's mane.
"I don't know. My toys are all here, and my roller skates."
"That's very true," I said. Not tonight, anyway."
"Oh," she said. "Okay. Molly says you're really nice."
"I try to be."
"Is he nice, Mouse?"
Mouse continued wagging his tail furiously and gave a quiet bark.
"Mouse is smart," she said, nodding. "Really super dog smart. We're reading James and the Giant Peach."
I blinked. Did she mean that she was reading the book to the dog, or that Mouse was reading the book, too? I mean, I already knew that he was as smart as most people, but I never really considered whether or not he could learn to do abstract things like reading. It seemed like a very strange notion. On the other hand, he was going to school. Hell, I only had a GED. If he stayed close enough to Maggie for long enough, the dog might wind up with more education than me. Then there'd be no talking to him.
"Don't tell people about Mouse, though, okay?" Maggie said, suddenly worried. "It's top secret."
"I won't," I said.
"Okay. Do you want to see my room?"
"I'd like that." I came up the stairs, and Maggie let go of the dog's mane with one hand to grab my right forefinger with it and to lead me down the hall. Maggie's room had, long ago, been Charity's sewing room. They'd cleaned it out and redecorated the little chamber in purple and pink and bright green. There was a tiny kid-sized desk with a chair and several toy boxes. The toys had all been put neatly away. There were a couple of school books on the desk. A closet stood slightly open and proved to have its floor covered in dirty clothes that hadn't made it into a small laundry hamper. There was a raised bed against one wall, the kind that usually came with a second one beneath it. There wasn't a lower bunk. Instead, there was a big futon mattress on the floor beneath the bed. Posters of brightly colored cartoon ponies adorned the walls and the ceiling above the bed. Once we were in the room, Mouse finally let out a few little whines and came over to me, grinning a big doggy grin. I spent a few minutes rubbing his ears and scratching him beneath the chin and telling him what a good dog he was and how much I'd missed him and what a good job he was doing. Mouse wriggled all over and gave my hands a few slobbery kisses and, in general, behaved exactly like a happy dog and not at all like a mystic, superpowered guardian creature from Tibet. Maggie climbed a little ladder to her bunk to watch the exchange closely. After a minute, Mouse leaned against me so hard that it nearly bowled me over, and then he happily settled down on the futon mattress beneath the little girl's bed.
"I have a monster under my bed, and it's Mouse," she said proudly. "There was another one there, but me and Mouse slayerized it."
I lifted an eyebrow. I mean, any other kid, I might have thought she was reporting a recent game of pretend. But on the other hand, I mean, she was a Dresden and all. Maybe she was giving me the facts and nothing but the facts. "He's the most awesome dog ever," I said. That pleased her immensely.
"I know."
She chewed on her lip thoughtfully, a gesture that reminded me so much of Susan that a tangible pang went through my chest. She said,
"would you like to tuck me in?"
"Sure," I said. She nodded and flopped down onto her pillow. I stepped up to the bed and took a few seconds to sort out the sheets and the blanket and to get them pulled over her. Once that was done, she said,
"Would you like to read me a story?"
Mouse's tail thumped enthusiastically against the wall. "Sure," I said. And we read Where the Wild Things Are. When I finished, she said,
"You didn't do the voices right."
"Hmm," I said. "Maybe I'll do better next time."
"I don't know," she said dubiously. "I guess you can try."
She looked at my face searchingly for a moment and then said in a tiny voice,
"Do you want to be my dad?"
I went blind for a few seconds until I blinked the tears away. "Sure," I said. It came out in a tight croak, but when I said it, she smiled at me. By the time I'd finished the second run-through of Sendak's Opus, she was asleep. I made sure the blankets had her all covered up and kissed her hair and then crouched down beside Mouse and put my arms around him. "Thank you, boy," I said. "Thank you for taking care of her." He leaned against me, tail wagging, and snuggled his huge head into my ribs. I petted him some more. "I have to go soon, but I need you to keep her safe. The carpenters, too. Okay?" He chuffed and snuggled a little closer. "Missed you too, boy," I said, rubbing his ears. "I just need a little time to figure this out, to figure out what comes next." Had I decided that I was going to be a dad to Maggie now? I examined myself and realized that indeed I had. When did that happen? And why hadn't anyone kept me in the loop? It had happened, I thought, the moment I had seen her. Talk to her. Oh, my God. That was terrifying. And exciting. All things considered, I wasn't sure I could put a lot of trust in my emotions at the moment, but one thing was certain. If I wanted to keep my word to my daughter, I'd have to come back. That meant staying alive tomorrow. I got up, gave Mouse a final round of petting and scratching, and padded quietly from the room into the upstairs hallway. The lights in the other rooms were out, except for the one in Michael and Charity's room. A light burned there. The door was slightly open. And I could see Charity sitting on the edge of the bed in flannel pajamas, a tall, blonde woman with an excellent physique whose hair was threading through with silver and style as she aged. Her tear-stained face was miserable as she spoke, presumably to her husband, seated on the bed beside her. I couldn't see him from there. Obviously, Michael had intended that talk to take place in private. I turned away from it and went back down the stairs. I sat down on the bottom steps and tried to clear my head. A few minutes later, Charity came down the stairs and sat down next to me. I made room. "Where's Michael?" I asked. "Praying over the children," she answered. "He always does that before he leaves. In case..." "Yeah," I said. "You know," Charity said, "I had intended to punch you in the nose twice the moment I saw you again. Once to make it bleed, once to break it."
"Oh?"
"Mm-hmm. The first time for trying to kill yourself, the second for using my daughter to do it."
You know about that?"
"How?"
"I watch. I listen."
"Her reaction to reports of your death was too much. It took time, but I eventually worked out why she was so furious at herself."
"You can hit me right now if you think it would help," I said.
"No," she said tiredly. "I just wanted to tell you something."
"Yeah?" She nodded.
"Kids need their father to come home safe, Harry. Make sure it happens."
"I'll bring him back to you or die trying, I promise."
Charity glanced at me and then shook her head with a weary smile. "I wasn't talking about Michael, Harry. I meant you." She glanced back up the stairs toward Maggie's room. "That child has lost everyone she's ever loved. Did you notice how close she stays to Mouse? Without him, I wonder if she'd be functioning at all. If anything should happen to you..."
"Ah," I said quietly.
"Maggie doesn't need to feel that pain again. Don't let her down."
I chewed on my lip and nodded with my watery eyes closed.
"Right. And please remember that Michael has children who need him too. Please."
"I'll bring him back or die trying," I repeated.
Charity exhaled a shaky breath and then touched my shoulder gently. "Thank you. God be with you and bring you home safe, Harry. Both of you."
Chapter 33. At 3:30 a.m., we rolled up to the evil lair in a soccer mom's minivan with a "My kid is an honor student" at bumper sticker on the back. It is worth noting that by the standards of my life, this was not a terribly incongruous entrance. Michael regarded the slaughterhouse for a moment after he had killed the ignition and said, "This is a bad place."
"Yep," I said. I rubbed at the small of my back.
I'd gotten a few hours' worth of sleep before we'd left, on the futon mattress on the floor beneath Maggie's bed. Mouse had been happy to snuggle up to me. The lummox likes to pretend he's still a tiny puppy that will fit on my lap if he tries hard enough, and I'd been too tired to argue with him. As a result, I'd had to practice defensive sleeping, and it had left my back a little twitchy. On the upside, even the modest amount of sleep I'd gotten had done wonders to restore me, or at least the power of the winter mantle. I felt practically normal, broken arm, gunshot wound, and all. Michael was dressed in his old mail, which he had kept clean and scoured free of rust, despite his retirement. He wore body armor beneath it. He'd put his big white cloak with its bright red cross on the left breast over it.
"You sure you couldn't just put something black on?" I asked him.
"You're gonna clash with all the bad guy robbery wear."
"That's the idea," Michael said.
"You don't get it, man," I said. "This building we're gonna hit belongs to John Marcone. We're supposed to go in without taking down their electronic systems. That means there will be cameras and pictures. The blindest security tech in the world could identify you, and your guardian angels won't protect you from Marcone's people."
Michael shook his head.
It won't come to that.
You say that, I said, but you don't know what Marcone is like.
Perhaps, he said, but I do know what the Almighty is like, Harry. And he wouldn't give me the strength to do this only to have it result in harm to my family. I grimaced.
Seems to me it would be polite of you to take a couple of prudent steps, like wearing dark clothes and a mask, so that the Almighty wouldn't need to go out of his way to arrange things for you.
He barked out a quick laugh and gave me a rueful smile. So you have been listening to me all this time. He shook his head. Nicodemus and his ilk operate in the shadows, in secret. The swords aren't meant for that. I have nothing to hide.
Hey, I said, letting my voice be annoyed. As shadowy ilk myself, I think I resent that statement.
Michael snorted. You destroy buildings, fight monsters openly in the streets of the city, work with the police, show up in newspapers, advertise in the phone book, and ride zombie dinosaurs down Michigan Avenue. And think that you work in the shadows? Be reasonable.
I will if you will, I said.
At least wear a ski mask.
No, Michael said calmly. The Lord is my helper, and I will not fear what man shall do unto me. Trust him, Harry.
Probably not in the cards, I said. His smile widened.
Then trust me.
I threw up my hands.
Fine, whatever.
Are you sure your people can find someplace safe to keep the Grail if we get it back? Because apparently they go out and use the coins to get snacks out of the vending machine that things go back into circulation so fast.
Part of the nature of the coins is to be in circulation, as you put it, Michael said. They can only be contained for so long. The Grail is a different proposition entirely. They'll keep it safe.
And you know the rules I have to play by, right? I asked.
You have to help Nicodemus recover the Grail, he said. After that, you can go weapons free.
Right. And you'll respect that?
I will do what is right, Michael said. I licked my lips.
Yeah, but could you maybe put off doing what is right until we get clear of Mab's restrictions?
All things considered, Michael said. No, I'm not taking chances.
Translation, he wasn't going to do anything, or not do anything, that might screw up Uriel's grace, no matter what.
Thank you, Mab, for this wonderful, wonderful game. Maybe next time we can play pin the tail on the wizard.
I'm pretty sure Nicodemus is going to play it straight, at least until right before we get back to Chicago, I said.
Why would he?
Because I'm going to say please.
Michael arched an eyebrow at me.
I'm going to say it in his native tongue, I said.
Power? Bingo.
Nicodemus hadn't warned his squires what to expect, and when Michael strode in at my side, Jordan and his brothers-in-arms produced a truly impressive number of weapons in what appeared to be a state of pure panic. Michael just stood there with his thumbs hooked into his belt, Amarachius hanging quietly at his side in its scabbard.
Son, he said to Jordan, don't you have anything better to do than point that thing at me?
Lower your weapons, I snarled in a voice loud enough to carry throughout the slaughterhouse, before I start downsizing your organization.
They didn't put their guns down, but my threat did make a lot of the squires eye me nervously.
Go me.
Hey, Nick, I shouted. Your boys are all jittery. You want to calm them down, or should I do it?
Gentlemen, Nicodemus called a moment later, I know who is with Dresden. Let them through.
Jordan and the others lowered their weapons with manifest reluctance, but kept their hands on them, ready to bring them to bear again at any time. Michael didn't move or take a threatening posture, but he swept his gaze from squire to squire, one by one. They all dropped their eyes from his, every one of them. We started down to the conference table, and Michael said,
I feel sorry for these men.
The tongue thing? I asked.
Removing their tongues is one way to keep their loyalty, Michael said.
Yeah, I love people who mutilate my body parts. He frowned.
It's designed to keep them isolated.
Think what it does to them. They can't talk, so how much more difficult is it for them to connect with other people? To form the kinds of bonds that might let them free themselves of this cult. They can't taste their food, which precludes eating for pleasure, and eating together is one of the primary means of forming real relationships between human beings. Think how much more difficult it makes even the simplest of interactions with outsiders, and how the shared experience of that hardship means that one's fellow squires will always be the only ones who truly understand his pain. He shook his head. It's the last step of their indoctrination for a reason. Once it's done, they no longer have a voice of their own.
It's not the same as not having a choice, I said. These guys have made their call.
Indeed, after being manipulated by Nicodemus and Anduriel as unwise young men, he shook his head. Some men fall from grace, some are pushed. Once their fingers pull the trigger, does it matter?
Of course it matters, Michael said. But it doesn't change what has to be done. I just wish they could find another way to fill the empty place inside them.
We'd reached the conference table by that time, where the crew was making final preparations. Anna Valmont, Hannah Asher, and Binder were all there, dressed in close-fit dark clothing, and each of them was wearing a shoulder holster. Valmont had a roll-up leather tool pouch laid out on the table, and was going through various bits of equipment in it one by one. Asher was sipping coffee, her bagel untouched on the plate in front of her. Binder was going over his gang's Uzis one more time. The loading doors at one end of the slaughterhouse rolled open, and a pair of large stepside vans rumbled into the place a moment later. Several squires set about getting them lined up and then rolling their rear doors open.
"Morning, Dresden," Hannah Asher said. "What happened to your girlfriend?"
"She's not my girlfriend," I said. "And she had a misunderstanding with Nicodemus."
Anna Valmont's eyes flicked up to me, hard.
"She's alive," I told her, "but she wasn't in any shape to go to work today."
"So you brought Captain Crusader instead?" Asher asked. "He looks like a Renaissance fair."
Binder abruptly stood up, his eyes widening.
"Bloody hell, girl. That's a knight of the sword."
Asher frowned.
"I thought there were only, like, three of those guys in the whole world."
"Two," Michael said, "at the moment."
Binder stared at Michael and narrowed his eyes in calculation.
"Oh, damn it. Dresden, this is what you do because Nicodemus gets in a tiff with your girlfriend? She's not my gr-"
I rubbed at the bridge of my nose. "Look, I want someone I know and trust watching my back. Murphy couldn't do it, so he's doing it instead."
"What a load of tripe," Binder said.
"You think I don't know what the coins and the swords are like with each other? You didn't bring him to watch your back. You brought him to fight."
"Let's just say I don't mind having a deterrent around," I said. "If Nicodemus plays it straight and keeps his word, I will too, and we'll all get rich."
Binder scowled and eyed Michael.
"Is that right, Knight?"
"Harry's generally a very honest man," Michael said. "I really don't care about the money, though." Binder and Asher both tilted their heads to one side, like a dog that has just heard a new noise. Anna Valmont smiled and shook her head slightly, going back to checking her tools.
"So, what happened last night?" Asher asked me. "Binder's goons drew him a picture of a lion. The ones who came back, I mean."
"Yeah, it got a little crazy," I said.
"Did you get the guy?" Binder asked.
"Nah, he skated," I said. "Nobody's fault, really. Tricky, slippery little bastard."
Binder eyed me. "Yeah, right. You give me a big speech about how you'll come down on my neck if I hurt anyone in your town. Then you two tear out of here to take up the chase, and Murphy winds up too busted up to continue after a misunderstanding with Nicodemus."
I gave him a beatific smile.
"Binder, relax.
The op isn't in any danger. I made sure he's not going to go to anyone. That was the point of chasing him down in the first place, right?"
Binder frowned. "I thought the White Council didn't let you use mind magic."
Which I hadn't meant at all, and which I really couldn't do, considering my utter lack of talent in that area, but Binder didn't know that.
"I did what needed to be done," I said. "And think of it like this. I don't have to stomp on your neck now."
Binder looked skeptical, but he didn't push it,
which was smart. Binder had a really formidable skill, but he was a one-trick pony. He wasn't up to facing a wizard of the White Council directly, and he knew it. Michael rounded himself up a cup of coffee and looked at me. I nodded, and he brought me back one. "That's a very large pen for just 4 goats," he noted. Which meant that the Janosqua had come back here last night and gotten a couple more meals in. Damn, but that thing ate a lot. It ate more than something that size should have been able to consume. But a lot of supernatural creatures had supernatural metabolisms that helped fuel their exceptional speed and strength. Ghouls could put down 40 or 50 pounds of meat in a meal and need more the next day. Maybe Big Shaggy had a similar high consumption engine fueling its physical power. I sipped coffee and waited. At 3:45, Goodman Gray came ambling in. The unassuming-looking man stopped 10 feet short of the table and stared hard at Michael. The knight returned the shifter's look and dropped the heel of his hand casually to the hilt of Amorakius, resting it there with his fingers relaxed. "What's wrong?" I asked him. "I don't like that man very much," Michael said. "He's done terrible things." "Obviously," Goodman Gray said, his tone wary. "I'm a monster for hire, but I got no quarrel with you today, Sir Knight." "Maybe," Michael said. "Maybe not." Gray's eyes flicked to me. "Do you really expect me to work with someone like this, wizard, on our side?" "Yes," I said. "You've been hired, haven't you? Show a little professionalism." Gray grunted and seemed to relax a little. "Well, I won't give him any cause to take issue with me. But if he does, don't think I won't take him apart." "Pretty sure you can't," I told him. "But it might be fun to watch you try it." Gray gave me a sour look and went over to the coffee pot. At 3:55, Nicodemus and Deirdre arrived together. Deirdre was in her demonic battle form, all purple scales and metallic ribbons of hair. Both sets of her eyes were focused on Michael warily. Nicodemus looked like he always did, but more smug.
"Good morning, everyone," he said. "Table, please."
In the shadows back behind Nicodemus, I could see the hulking outline of the Janosqua lurking in silence. We all gathered around the table where Nicodemus had laid out a large piece of paper with a map of the bank drawn cleanly upon it.
"This will be a simple entry," he said.
He pointed at the front doors of the bank.
"We'll go in through these doors. There will be between 3 and 6 security personnel, and I will expect Binder and Dresden to keep their attention and eventually neutralize them. The rest of us will head straight back to the vaults. There are 2 large security doors in the way, but we aren't going to bother opening them. Miss Asher will go through the walls beside them, here and here."
He marked the appropriate places with a red pen.
"After that, Miss Valmont and Mr. Gray will move forward into the main vault. Miss Valmont will open the vault's door, and Mr. Gray will open the target's private storage room. Once those systems have been circumvented and the doors opened, it will be safe to bring our wizards into the vault." He smiled widely. "And then the real fun can begin. Are there any questions?"
"What happens when we get where we're going?" I asked. "You got a map for that?"
"Unfortunately, no," Nicodemus said. "Though our path should be an obvious one, our target uses active defenses to protect his vaults, not obfuscation."
"No map," I said, "just some vague references to gates."
"One does not attain great reward without daring similarly great risk," Nicodemus said. "We will simply have to adapt to what we find as we enter."
I did not for a minute believe that Nicodemus had no further information about Hades' vault, but there wouldn't be much point in saying it.
"If that is all," Nicodemus said, "we shall load up. Dresden and his escort, Gray and Valmont, will be in the leftmost van. The rest of us will take the one on the right. I took the liberty of stocking them with heavy-duty backpacks for each of you, in order to allow you to gather up your shares. Mr. Binder, 20 of your associates in each van, if you please."
"Got it," Binder said.
He produced his circle of wire and began calling up suits, issuing them an Uzi and a couple of spare clips as they arrived. They rushed to the waiting vans, leaping up into them with a will. Michael watched and shook his head.
"Oh, cheer up, Mr. Carpenter," Nicodemus said. "By the time the sun rises this morning, you may be $20 million richer."
"I have a family. I am already rich beyond measure," Michael said. "But I really wouldn't expect you to understand that." Nicodemus's face went blank, his eyes cold. I took note of that. It was far more reaction than I'd seen from him this whole time. Something about what Michael had said struck home.
"The time for talking and planning is over," Nicodemus said. "Now is the time for action. Everyone, get in the vans."
Chapter 34. The inside of the van was crowded, with 20 of Binder's goons crammed in with the four of us and a couple of squires driving.
"All right, Dresden," Gray said. "Let's have your wrists."
"What?" I said.
"Oh, right. The manacles."
"What's he talking about?" Michael asked.
"Thorn manacles," I said. "They inhibit magical ability. They should greatly reduce the odds that I'll blow out any of the building's security systems by walking past. And we need them to stay up and functioning until we get all the doors open."
"His wrist is broken," Michael said to Gray. "Will they fit on his ankles?"
Gray held up a set of manacles on a heavy steel chain. They looked just like the ones I'd seen before, only they had the heavy gleam of steel to them instead of that weird silvery metal the she used. The inner surfaces of the cuffs were lined with small, sharp thorns of steel. They would bite into the flesh when they were locked on, and with that steel breaking my skin, the winter mantle would go to pieces. That wasn't going to feel good.
"Doesn't matter," I said, eyeing them. "If either of the cuffs is on, I can't use the magic. Just have them both on one wrist and wrap the chain around to keep it out of my way. Gimme."
"Sure you don't want me to do it?" Gray asked.
"Nah, I dislike you enough already. I'll put them on."
I took the manacles from Gray and gave Michael a look to let him know that I wanted him to pay attention. He frowned and did. I elbowed myself enough room to wrap the chain around my wrist. Then I closed my eyes for a moment and took slow, deep breaths, concentrating. Blocking out pain was a lesson I'd learned a long time ago, and I could do it pretty well if I had time to prepare for it. Mostly the bad guys aren't that courteous before they start hurting me, but fortunately this time the bad guy was me, and I was willing to cut myself a break. It took me a couple of minutes to erect the mental barriers, and then I opened my eyes, pulled up the sleeve of my duster, and fastened both manacles onto my right wrist, locking them on with their key. Steel bit into my skin with 100 tiny teeth, and the winter mantle vanished. As suddenly as light comes on when you flip the switch, my body started reporting injuries. My arm was pretty horrid, but my back had apparently turned into a single large contusion when the Junosqua slammed me into that parked car. My calf burned steadily where I'd been shot. My feet were killing me too, which, what the hell? Had I gotten a pair of shoes the wrong size or something? I was aching in the knees, and somehow I'd collected a cut on my tongue and on one of my gums. I hadn't really noticed them before, though I sure as hell felt them now. And my head. Oh, my aching head. Mab's little silver earring was as cold as an ice cream truck in Antarctica, but with its numbing influence reduced by the steel, my head felt like it was going to crack open and spill out streams of molten lead. I realigned my mental shields for a moment, once I knew exactly what I was supposed to be blocking out, and then straightened up slowly.
"Harry," Michael said. "You just went pale."
"Hurts," I said shortly. "I'll be fine."
I put the key to the manacles in my pocket, then picked up my oversized duffel bag and started rooting around in it. I tied a leather thong onto my wizard's staff and now wore it over one shoulder like a rifle.
"Gray, I'm going to be making all kinds of light and noise once we're inside. If you feel like doing something about the guards, try to make it non-fatal."
"Or what?" Gray asked.
"The manacles come off and I get upset with you," I said.
"Maybe I'll just let them shoot you," he said.
I gave him a pleasant smile.
"If you do, who's going to open your way to the vault, eh?" Took me years of formal instruction to learn enough to make that happen. I guarantee you that Asher can't pull that one off. I squinted at Gray.
Ask you something?
Sure.
Why take money for something like this? I asked.
Someone with your talents can get it any way he wants.
Gray shrugged.
No mystery. Everyone's got to pay the rent, he said, and something in his voice put a capital letter on the last word.
I don't get it, I said.
I know, Gray replied placidly. Not my problem.
If you don't mind, gentlemen,
Balmont said, speaking for the first time since we got in the van,
you may think your bits of the job are simple, but mine is the next best thing to impossible. I would appreciate some quiet, please.
I eyed Valmont, grunted, and fell silent, working to rearrange the contents of my duffel to my satisfaction. It didn't take us long to get where we were going. The van came to a stop, and a moment later, Jordan rolled up its rear door. The Capristi building is one of the last skyscrapers to be had on the north end of the city of Chicago proper, right across the street from Lincoln Park. It's made of white concrete and glass, a mediocre bit of soulless modern architecture that's all monotonous squares and right angles stretching up and up into the still sleeting skies. Between the weather and the time, the streets were almost completely empty and still, which actually bothered me a little bit. That stillness would have made our vans pretty obvious to anyone who saw them moving. I stepped out of the van, slipped on the ice, and would have fallen if I hadn't grabbed onto the truck. Right. No winter mantle to help with the ice. By now, there was half an inch of transparent ice lying over every surface in sight. Power lines were bowed down with the weight of it. In the park behind me, the trees were bent almost double, and here and there, branches had cracked and fallen beneath its weight. The streets had been a mess, and only careful driving and the weight of the heavily loaded vans had kept them from slithering all over the place. A sign on the first floor of the Capristi building read, Verity Trust Bank of Chicago, which was a fine name for a mob bank. The first floor was the bank's lobby, with the secure floors being on the levels below. At least half the outside of the building was glass, and I could see a security guard inside staring at the vans. Michael, I said, striding toward the guard, drawing my gear out of my duffel and preparing it. Doors? Michael stepped in front of me and said, as if reminding himself, The building belongs to a criminal overlord and functions to assist him in this evil enterprise. Then he drew Amarakius, made two sweeping slashes, and the glass fell entirely out of the door immediately in front of me. I deployed the material I'd picked up the day before, specifically a self-lighting butane torch and a bundle of 24 large Roman candles I had duct-taped together. I held the roundish bundle of fireworks under my left arm and was already lighting their fuses en masse with the butane torch as Michael leapt aside. By the time the guard had begun to rise from his chair, 24 20-shot Roman candles were sending out screaming projectiles that detonated with deafening cracks of thunder. It was a constant stream of fire and sound and light and smoke, and the poor guard had no idea how to react. He'd been fumbling for his gun when the first projectile went off not a foot from his nose, and before he could recover from that, 24 more were going off all around him. I hated to admit it, but it was pretty gratifying. I mean, it was like holding my own personal pyrotechnic minigun. So many rounds were spewing out of the various Roman candles. They filled the air with a scorched scent of sulfur and thick smoke that I hoped would confuse the surveillance cameras. The guard was hit by 20 or 30 of the sizzling munitions in a couple of seconds and flung himself down behind his desk while I peppered the wall behind him with more of the raucous projectiles. While I did that, Gray bounded into the place, danced between the last few rounds from my bundle, and slugged the guard across the jaw with bone-cracking force. The guard went down in a moaning heap. Gray looked at something behind the desk and said, He got to the silent alarm. Right, I said. I dropped the first bundle of Roman candles and pulled the second one out of the duffel bag. I started walking toward the stairs down to the vault below as I lit the second bundle and began hosing down the top of the stairway with more fireworks just as two more men in the same uniform came pelting up the stairs. These two weren't as slow as the first one, and they had shotguns. That said, there's a really limited amount of damage you can do when you can't see or hear, and loud things are going off bang half an inch from your face, or giving you first-degree burns as they sizzle into your arm. They got a few aimless rounds off before Deirdre, in her demon form, swarmed past them, walking on her ribbons of hair as if they were manifold legs of some kind of sea crustacean. A couple of them lashed out, slashing the shotguns in half, and the guards began to beat a hasty retreat back down the stairs. Gray flung himself down the stairwell after them, not touching the stairs with his feet on the way, and there came the sounds of efficient and brutal violence from below, beneath the howling and banging of the fireworks.
"Clear!"
Gray shouted. I went to the top of the stairs and looked down. Gray had both guards lying back to back at the bottom of the stairs in front of the first security door. He was busy using their handcuffs to cross-bind their wrists to one another. I spattered him with the last few rounds from the Roman candles. He rolled his eyes and gave me a disgusted look. "Oops," I said, and discarded the exhausted bundle of fireworks. Nicodemus appeared on the stairs beside me, looking down at Gray. He arched an eyebrow.
"All three, still alive. Going soft, Gray."
"They set off the silent alarm," Gray said. "Means the authorities are coming. It will be easier for Binder to convince them to sit and talk rather than simply assaulting the place if we have prisoners instead of corpses."
"I suppose that's true," Nicodemus said. He turned and called,
"Mr. Binder, bring your associates in, if you would, and prepare to defend the building. Miss Asher, we are ready for you now."
I put the butane torch out, put it back in my duffel, and then slung my staff down off my shoulder. Nicodemus was eyeing me as I did.
"Fireworks," he said.
"You think you're the only guy in the world who can get things done without his supernatural gadgets?" I asked him. He waved a hand at the smoke in his face and said mildly,
"Let us hope that their firefighting systems do not include..."
An alarm began to blare, and sprinkler heads all around the first floor started up, spraying chilly, slightly stale-smelling water everywhere.
"Sprinklers," Nicodemus finished on a sigh.
Hannah Asher came in, moving quickly, and eyed me with disgust.
"Fireworks? Seriously?"
"Loud and distracting, remember?" I called after her as she descended the stairs. "I am the king of loud and distracting."
"Not only do I have to burn through a wall," she muttered, "I've got to do it in a downpour, too."
"Get tough. It should help muffle the excess magical energy," I said, maybe a bit grumpily. Asher shot a look back up at me and gestured at the sprinklers.
"You did this on purpose?"
"Yeah, well, sometimes when I get bored, I stop and think." She held up a small spray can.
"How am I supposed to lay out a circle on the floor when there's a layer of water over it? Did you think about that?"
"Deirdre," Nicodemus said.
Deirdre promptly swarmed halfway down the stairs, and then there were several sharp sounds of impact as her metallic hair shot out, surrounding Asher, and slammed onto the floor around her. The flat, ribbon-like hairs spread out, edged down, scraping along the marble tile like a squeegee, sweeping the standing water away. Asher looked like she nearly had a heart attack when Deirdre did that, and cast a glare up at the Denarian. But then she took a can and sprayed a layer of what looked like some kind of aerosolized plastic or rubber onto the floor. She laid it out in a large circle around her, overlapping the circle onto the wall, and continuing it up to a few inches above her head. It was lopsided, but technically a circle didn't have to be a perfect one to contain the magic. It was just a lot more efficient, not to mention professional, that way. Asher, who was looking damn appealing in her wet clothes, and damn it, how could I blame my reaction on the winter mantle when it was being held at bay by iron, went over the circle again, making sure the plastic spray was especially thick at the joints of the floor and wall. Then she nodded once, bent, and twisted her wrist so that a couple of drops of her blood fell from the manacles onto the circle. It snapped up into place at once, a screen of invisible energy, and she promptly unlocked her manacles and dropped them onto the floor at her feet. Then she narrowed her eyes, touched her finger to the wall inside the circle, and murmured a quiet word. Light sprang out from her fingertip, sudden and fierce, and steam began to hiss up where droplets of water fell onto her hand or the wall.
She began to move her fingertips slowly, and I watched as marble and the drywall and the concrete and metal beneath it began to crack and blacken and part. Glowing motes and sparks flew back from her, falling thickly on her hand and her arm, then blackening and dropping to the floor, burning holes in her sleeve, but leaving her flesh, as far as I could see, untouched. I lifted my eyebrows at that. I mean, I guess I could turn my finger into an arc welder, sure, but that wouldn't mean that my entire hand wouldn't burn to a crisp as I did it. That kind of inurement to the elements required an entirely different order and magnitude of talent, talent very few wizards, in my experience, possessed. Man, when Asher said she mostly worked with fire, she wasn't kidding. Binder and his troops came into the bank while she was working, and Binder immediately scouted out the place and started assigning groups to various defensive positions. As he did that, Anna Valmont slid silently across the floor until she stood near me. She looked at the thorn manacles on my wrist.
"I can't stand to look at those things," she said. "It must hurt."
I bit down on a sharp reply. She wasn't looking for that by standing near me.
"Yeah, pretty much."
She fiddled with her gear and licked her lips.
"How long do you think before you can take them off?"
"No idea," I said. "Depends on Asher, I guess." There was a loud snapping sound and a squeal of parting metal from below, and Asher half snarled, "That's right, bitch," and began putting her manacles back on in a businesslike fashion. It had taken her less than 3 minutes to slice an opening large enough to admit a big guy into the reinforced wall. She smeared the circle with her foot, and the excess energy of the spell dispersed into the air to be immediately smothered by the falling water. Then she put her hand on the cut section and began to push. Gray slid in front of her and said,
"Best let me go first, Miss Asher."
He set his shoulders and almost casually shoved the cut section of wall down, and it fell through to the hallway beyond with a satisfying boom, and was instantly echoed by the hollow, coughing blast of a shotgun from the hallway beyond. Gray was flung off of his feet to the ground, where he promptly became the origin point of a growing puddle of blood. Asher let out a choked sound and flattened herself desperately to the side of the opening, into the shelter of the unexposed side of the stairwell. The shotgun boomed twice more, and then Deirdre was through the opening. The shotgun went off again, and then a man screamed. Then silence. I snarled wordlessly. I rushed down the stairs to check on Asher, and then peered through the hole in the wall. Deirdre crouched beyond it, on all fours like a wary cat, her hair spread out around her and moving slowly like strands of kelp in a gentle current. A fourth guard lay unmistakably dead on the floor in front of her, his shotgun still gripped loosely in his hand.
"Gray," Nicodemus said, his voice tight.
Of course he was worried about Gray. Gray hadn't done his job with the retina scanner yet. Asher was shaken but untouched. I gave her shoulder a quick squeeze and turned to Gray, trying to remember what I knew about first aid and tourniquets. I needn't have bothered. Gray had already begun sitting up even before I turned around, and his hair was mussed. Other than that and the bloodied clothing, he looked entirely healthy. His expression was annoyed.
"Damn, that hurts."
"Whiner," I said. "One little load of buckshot to the chest," I offered him my hand. Gray stared blankly at my hand for a second, as if it had taken him a moment to remember what the gesture meant. Then he took it, and I pulled him up to his feet. He wobbled once, and then shook his head and steadied. "You okay?" I asked. He gestured at all the blood on the floor.
"Hit my heart. I'll be fine in a minute."
"Man," I said, impressed. "Takes a licking and keeps on ticking." Gray showed me his teeth, then turned, poised, and contained once more, and stalked through the doorway after Deirdre. Hannah Asher got slowly to her feet and stood staring down at the smeared puddle of blood on the floor. She swallowed and started back up the stairs. I put out a hand and stopped her. "It'll take the cops time to get here, but you probably don't want to be standing around on the first floor when they do," I said.
"Too right," said Binder, coming up behind Valmont, still at the stairway's top and nudging her down like a bulldog herding a hesitant child. "Bullets are no respecters of persons. Go on, girl."
"And Ashlove," don't forget to fill my pack.
Asher had a couple of empty black backpacks slung over her shoulder. I know, the red ones.
Nicodemus came to the top of the stairs, dragging the unconscious guard, and came down the steps, taking the guard along none too gently. Once he had the man to the bottom, he interlaced his handcuffs with those of the men already on the floor and cuffed him there.
"Well done, Miss Asher," Nicodemus said. "We'll secure the hallway, and you can repeat your excellent performance on the second door. Miss Valmont, if you would accompany us, please. I'll want you working on the main vault door the moment we have access to it."
Anna Valmont tensed beside me, her fingers fretting over the surface of her tool roll, constantly wiping droplets of water away.
"Michael," I said, "why don't you go on in and make sure Valmont has everything she needs?"
Michael arched an eyebrow at me, but nodded and came down the stairs to Anna Valmont's side. He gave her an encouraging smile, which she returned hesitantly, and the two of them went on through in the wake of the others.
"Dresden," Nicodemus said, his tone amused. "Surely you don't think I'd do anything to the woman simply because her purpose had been served."
"Not if you want that way opened, you won't," I said. Nicodemus smiled at me. He had buckled on a sword belt bearing the long blade he'd used earlier and a curved Bedouin dagger.
"There, you see, you can learn to play the game after all."
He vanished through the security door. A moment later, a huge shadow moved through the narrow stairway. I never saw the Janosqua go by, but I felt the brush of patchy fur against the skin of my right hand and smelled a faint reek of its odor in the air, and bits of ash and the scent of burned hair came from the edges of the torched opening as the huge beast squeezed through it.
"This stinks," Binder said a moment later, his voice pitched low. "This stinks all to hell."
"Huh," I said. "Maybe it's just the furball." He snorted, and we waited in silence for another 3 or 4 minutes until Asher reappeared, newly muddy with ashes and soot from burning through the second wall, wearing the manacles again.
"That big thing creeps me out," she said.
"Too right," Binder said. "Gotta wonder what something like that wants with jewels, eh?"
He wasn't wrong about that.
"You're right," I said. "It smells."
Asher traded a long look with Binder.
"Should we leave?"
Binder grimaced.
"And leave old Nick unable to get through his fiery gate? He'd take that personal, I think. What is Uncle Binder's rule number 2?
"Keep your eyes on the money," Asher said.
"That's right," Binder said.
"Don't take things personal. Don't get emotional. We're professionals, love. Do the job, get paid, get gone."
"There could be more than money at stake here," I said quietly.
"Nick and his cup?" Binder asked. "Been a lot of bad men and a lot of powerful artifacts since this ball started spinning. It'll spin on."
"Maybe," I said. "Maybe not. Nicodemus is connected like few others. What if I could make you an offer?"
"Cash?" Binder asked.
I grimaced.
"Well, not as such."
He made a tisking sound and glanced at Asher.
"What's Uncle Binder's rule number 1?
"Money or nothing," she said. "Anything else costs too much." He nodded.
"So don't offer me favors, wizard, or lenience from the White Council, or power from a fairy queen. Those things aren't payment. They're pretty, pretty things with strings attached, and sooner or later you're all wrapped up like a bug in a web. Money or nothing."
"What about freedom?" I asked him. "The cops are going to have this place surrounded by the time we get back. Do you think you're going to fight your way out past an army of CPD? Binder let out a low belly laugh.
"Look at you, Dresden. Damn, but you're a Boy Scout. This is a mob bank. Belongs to your local robber baron. 8 minutes since the silent alarm went off. And where are the sirens? Where are the uniforms?"
I grimaced. I'd noticed that, too.
"You really think the alarms call the gendarmes?" He shook his head. 20 to 1, it'll go to his people first. Then they can decide if they want to call in the coppers or handle the matter themselves.
Yeah, Marcone's people. Gulp. Binder busied himself making sure the groaning, stirring guards had been thoroughly disarmed and relieved of their handcuff keys.
"Now, if you'll excuse me,
Odds are good, if this Marcone of yours is so savvy, someone will start playing circle games with me. I'll need to be ready to counter them. He pointed a finger at Asher.
For the 100th time, the red ones, Asher said, quirking a slight smile.
I'll buy us a nice tropical island with a nice beach and get you a new swimsuit, he said, winking.
You should be so lucky, Asher said back.
I'll hold the door for you lot. Don't be too long. Binder went up the stairs, his beady eyes sparkling, fairly bristling with energy.
Huh, I said. What? Asher asked.
You and Binder. Not a thing. Asher's mouth turned up bitterly at the corners.
Not for lack of trying.
Well, I said, kind of hard to blame him. You're damned attractive.
Not him trying, she said. Me. He's turned me down.
She looked up the stairs for a moment and sighed.
Rule number one, he's not into entanglements.
Oh, I said, trying to imagine Asher coming on to Binder and getting turned down. Granted, I'd turned her down, too. Which, now that I thought about it, just couldn't have been awesome for her self-image. Doesn't matter how pretty you are, what's important is how pretty you feel. No one feels pretty when they hear no often enough.
Don't take this the wrong way, I said. But you would not believe how many times I've had pretty girls who would have eaten me alive, like, literally, make a pass at me. Makes a guy a little tense about it.
Asher scratched at her nose with one finger, making the manacles jingle. She grimaced as the thorns dug at her wrists.
Wait a minute. You're saying I'm too pretty to be attractive?
To a guy in my business, maybe, I said. Someone as alluring as you, there's a high twitch factor. Binder strikes me as the type to have the same kind of wariness.
Her voice turned thoughtful. So if I'd been a little older and a little dumpier, maybe I'd have had some luck with you, like Murphy.
I scowled. Murphy's made of muscle. You just can't see it under the suit and the body armor, I said. And she hasn't gotten lucky with me either. Asher stared at me for a second and blinked slowly.
You're serious, aren't you?
We're complicated, I said.
Because you're twitchy? And she's had a couple of divorces.
And her ex-boyfriend kinda shot me.
What?
I asked him to, I said hurriedly.
What?
My mouth just kept running. Plus there was this whole initiation rite with Mab, except I think that only happened in my brain or something. Traumatic, like getting it on with a hurricane. I think it's kinda put me off sex in general. Asher stared at me for a second more, then shook her head and turned away.
Man, she said. Don't take this the wrong way, Dresden, but thanks for turning me down. Kind of dodged a bullet on that one.
Hey, I protested.
Seriously, she said. Way too much drama there for anyone sane.
We're not dramatic, I said. Just
complicated, she asked.
She shook her head.
It isn't complicated. You just open up and let someone in. And whatever comes after that, you face it together.
It isn't that simple.
The hell it isn't. You had a chance for that, and you turned it down? You're a fucking idiot.
I'm not making the same mistake. Footsteps came from the hallway beyond the security door, and Michael appeared, Amorakius in hand. The sword was glowing with a faint, angry light.
Harry, he said, trouble.
What's happening?
Nicodemus is about to kill Anna Valmont.
And you're here?
Four of them and one of me, he said. I got out the key to my manacles and made sure it was handy.
Dresden, Asher said, her voice tense. If you blow out the electronics, you'll blow the whole job.
I love it when a posh bird talks dirty,
called Binder merrily from upstairs. I ground my teeth, took my staff in my right hand, and said to Michael, come on. And then I took off down the hallway.
Chapter 35. The hallway beyond the first security door ran for a bit less than 100 feet, and I found the mental shields against my various pains fluttering as I put more demand on my body. I ground my teeth and got through it, while Michael moved with effortless, well, grace at my side, even steadying me once when I wobbled. At the end of the hall was another security door with a hole scorched through the wall beside it. And again I was treated to the stench of burned Janosqua hair. I ducked and went through the hole with Michael right behind me, and found myself in a room that was walled on two sides with what at first glance looked like lockers, and which I realized a second later were security deposit boxes. Minimum security, I guessed, where people stored copies of their important paperwork and such from the size of them. The third wall was made of obdurate, unjointed steel, broken only by a large steel door with a relatively small, unobtrusive control panel in its center. The panel didn't look like cutting-edge tech to me. It was simply a keypad.